Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Bitches on Comics. I'm Monica Estrella-Negra, and I have a special, special quote for you. Wednesday, March 5th, 2025. Tornadoes are smashing hell out of Alabama, Kentucky, Tennessee, and two or three other states. 300 people dead so far. And there's a blizzard freezing the northern Midwest, killing even more people. In New York and New Jersey, a measles epidemic is killing people. Measles. I say that with a capital M, if you can envision that. But that is an excerpt from Parable of the Sower by well-known time traveler Octavia E. Butler. Come back. Please come back.
Oh, man.
Please. We need
what
help.
What a curse. What a curse to see the future. What a curse, and to predict it and to try to warn people. But how beautiful. I'm glad we have the text at the same time, you know? I feel like anything Octavia E. Butler just like always makes my brain go galaxy mode. Like everything she was doing was like so transformative, even when it was using the tropes that were very common in science fiction and fantasy. And that was just so much fun to read. And also like chilling. Like every single thing is like, fuck! Like that's a good point, and I don't know what to do with that. She's like, keep reading, you know? Anyways, I am your co-host, S.E. Fleenor. It's always hard to follow an Octavia Butler quote, but at the same time, here I am doing my best. What a maniac. Yeah, things are dark. And so, as I like to say, I laugh to keep from crime. And that is why I am not doing crime.
Crime. Do crime. It's okay. Laws are fake. Laws are
no
fake.
One is suggesting that anyone do crime. On that note, I would like to welcome, oh my God, one of the coolest people I've ever. You stop it now.
I'm sorry.
We're a mess, y'all. It's, you know what? When you sit here at the end of the world, what do? You laugh to keep from crime. Okay, enough of my own jokes. I am delighted to be here today with a very special guest who is one of my dearest friends in the world. I'm in here with two of my besties, which is just what a beautiful life I get to lead. I'm very excited. But, you know, she's not just a friend. She is an author. And this is the incredible Maria Dong, who wrote Liar, Dreamer, Thief, and the book that's the topic of today's conversation, the new sci-fi psychological thriller. I always call it a sci-fi psychological horror, but you know, it's just me, called Psychopomp. I am so excited. I love this book so much. I can't wait to talk about it. But if you don't know Maria, you might be interested to find out that her short fiction, articles, and poetry have been published in dozens of magazines, including The Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy.
Twice. In a row. 2 years in a row.
In a row. Come on. Also, Lightspeed, Augur, Nightmare, Correo, Fantasy, Apex, and Apparition Literary Magazine. You don't know any of those, I'm sure, if you like science fiction and fantasy. Just kidding. She's the coolest. And her story in the beginning of Me, I Was a Bird. People, you have to read it. It's so good. It was a finalist for the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award. Oh my God. Maria Dong, thank you so much for being here. How you doing?
How am I doing? Well, given the context of the amazing quote that we kicked off with, I think like all of my responses today are going to be contextual. If this is the only way to do it, right? So
yeah.
As we watch everything burn down around our ears, I suppose that in this exact moment, I am not crying and therefore fine. So that's where I'm at.
Real. Yeah. Absolutely real. It's awesome to finally meet you too.
It is really nice to finally meet you. I've heard so much about you. I've also listened to you quite a bit now. And so it's like, I know Essie knows this, but sometimes my ADHD like errors out and I think people are in the room and I start talking back to the recording. And then it's like, no, this is still a podcast. They can't hear me. Like, very embarrassing.
I regularly get texts that were like, I was just talking to you. And I'm like, how? I'm me, but I'm here.
It's like a really weird parasocial relationship, right?
Parasocial at all because we're friends.
I'm just saying there's like a version of you that exists in the podcast. right, that I'm talking back to. This is such a great intro to this book, right, in a weird way. But I'm hallucinating a version of you that talks back to me through the podcast, so.
Oh my God, this is like an alt Severance.
Mm-hmm. This is actually like the 90th time something I've written has been comped to Severance, so that's perfect. That's like great. Yeah.
You know, the vibe is right. The vibe mm-hmm. is right. I think mindfuck is one of the top terms I would use to describe your writing.
Yeah, and that's funny because like when I write it, I don't think it's that weird or like, you know, that surreal. I always turn it in and I'm like, this is a cozy mystery. And then my agent's like, what? So, yeah. But I'm not even, I wish I was joking, but I'm being very serious right now. Liar, Dreamer, Thief, I mentioned this last time. I was literally in the editorial call with the editor that would buy that book. And she was like, where do you see this on the shelf? And I said, I think it's kind of a cozy mystery. And she was like, it is not. Like, it is a psychological thriller. And I was like, really? And the funny thing is, if you look at the like feedback from actual readers, the ones that start their comments with, I have ADHD, also say, and I found this cozy. So whatever that means.
Oh, I like that. Mm-hmm.
The people have spoken.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when I say mindfuck, I don't mean it like, I mean it as like a compliment. Mm. Like, I enjoy, it's like, you're screwing with my head, but in a way that helps me see a bigger world. And that's like, you know, like, as some people have used psychedelics throughout human history to do, I feel like that's kind of, at least for me, some of the work that the kind of weird fiction you weave through your genres, that's the work it does in my mind.
I love that. My biggest fear, I think, with my work is always that it's too derivative and boring. So it's always nice when people are like, this is insane. I'm like, oh, good. Okay, great.
Monica just bobbed her head so hard when you said that. She was like, that's crazy.
I mean,
and that's just like, huh? Like,
Well, it can't surprise me, right? Oh, that's not even remotely true. I always forget everything I've written. And then later people are like, oh, this thing. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? Like, what?
Okay, so Psychopomp, you were starting to say before we started the episode, and then I was like, don't talk anymore. We're putting it on the episode. And y'all were like, okay, cool. We'll do that. I thought we were recording. And we weren't. So.
And I only peed myself a little in fear. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I hope no one's afraid, except the people who should be. They're none of you. They're never you guys, you know? Anywho. Oh my God, I'm a mess right now. But I would like to hear about what it feels like to tell the future, because your book is so timely in a way that is uncomfortable.
This keeps happening to me. Yeah.
And I'll just for listeners' sake, I'll do a super light, quick and dirty version. Psychopomp is the story of Young, a woman who is in a debtor's prison on the moon. And y'all, she's not having a great time. She's actually not enjoying being imprisoned, which some readers find strange, which is very confusing for me, but we're going to keep moving. And it is this incredibly delicate story about the manipulation that happens in intimate partnerships at some points. It's about the long reach of fascism and, frankly, private prisons specifically. As an arm of fascism, it is a deeply anti-carceral book, and it's deeply psychological. We spend a lot of time with the main character, Young, inside her spacesuit with her, and it is stunningly beautiful. And so you were telling me off the air, I think earlier today, and then last time we talked, that this book started a long time ago, that you wrote it 7 years ago, is that right?
Yeah. So one thing a lot of people don't know about the whole like novel process is much like film, things take forever. And usually, especially if you're early in your career and you are either on submission with a book or you are in the process of having a book published. So like someone's acquired the book and it hasn't come out yet. There's like usually a 2-year lead time between those two polls. You don't get to sell anything else in that time. And at that time, I was pretty frantically writing. I was in like a pretty bad depressive episode. I had not really realized yet I had ADHD, but I had reached the point where like it had destroyed my life, right? I think a lot of people who are diagnosed as adults, they get there because they have like a burnout episode, right? They hold things together for like years or even decades. And in my case, I went to grad school. I finished grad school. I was like studying for my boards and I just couldn't like function anymore. It was really, really bad. And then I didn't realize it yet that I had that problem. And so then I got my first OT job and I was like working and it was terrible. And I was getting more and more depressed and kind of suicidal, because that's also a feature of burnout that a lot of people don't talk about, is like you get to the point where you're like, in order to get out of the situation, I should just end my life. Like, that's a way out, right? And so at the time I was writing pretty frantically in an effort to just kind of like depersonalize from my life generally. A lot of people are like, oh, you shouldn't write unless you feel the joy of it. But I always find the opposite to be true for me. Like, I basically write because if I don't, then I have to be in my body and it's very uncomfortable and I don't want to be there. So anyway, so I wrote a book called Bad Moon Child that we went out on sub with. It's the book I got my agent with after Pitch Wars 2018. So beginning of 2019, we went out on sub with it. And before that happened, I entered the Pitch Wars contest with it. And while I was waiting to hear back on if I was going to get into this contest or not, I wrote this book, Psychopomp. So it's been 7 years, I think, right? 2025 to 2018. What is that? I don't know. And it's actually very similar to the draft that we went out with. And we did go out to all these major houses and stuff. And, you know, publishing is very corporatist. And so, like, most of my writing gets rejected because it's too literary for genre and it's too genre for literary. Like, I get that over and over and over and over again. Or sometimes I get that it's like weird. And those are like the two poles. But yeah, so it was funny because the book we went out with had a pandemic in it, and then a pandemic happened. And then I wrote this book and this book didn't sell. And now this is happening. And I'm like looking at the other things I've written going like, oh no, I don't want these to happen to us.
I think especially with the opening quote, and I think, you know, I've heard a lot of people who've been deeply invested in organizing, activism, feeling something similar, which is it really sucks to be right.
Yeah.
It's actually not very fun to call it based on what you see. Like, I think we all kind of feel some vindication for Octavia E. Butler, but I don't know that she would feel that. I don't know how she would feel, obviously, but I don't know. I think it really sucks to be right about this. I think it really sucks to...
The original version of the book had a villain, because when I write books, I don't know how they're going to end. And so originally I just had a villain, and then later it didn't work. And it was Elon Musk. That was the original villain of the book. I was like, who, and this was 7-8 years ago, who embodies like a corporatist capitalist, like, you think it's kind of cool. Because
damn it, Maria.
I know. Why did I do this to us?
I mean, I wish it was you doing it. I think it's more observational skills,
yeah.
Pattern recognition, right? Some of the things that people don't think about neurodivergent people being very good at.
It's vibes. He just has evil vibes. He's always had evil vibes.
Super evil vibes. Yeah. Ugh, Elon Musk. And you know what? I think in a way, he's still the bad guy of the book.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you don't need to know the face of the evil billionaire who makes CPI possible. CPI is the corporate organization.
Yeah.
The corporation. That's the fucking word for that. The corporation who runs the prison on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
But also seems to be like in control of pretty much everything on the planet too. Mm-hmm. Isn't that fascinating? I wonder how that happens.
I'm getting so depressed. Like, I wrote this book too, right? And I'm like, oh, this is okay. That's great.
It is. It's heavy. It's heavy shit. I think too, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge something you said that is also in a primary theme in the book, which is suicidal ideation mm-hmm. and suicide attempts. And I think pointing out the commonness of that for people with ADHD is really important. And I think in this instance, it's really important too, because the character is so poor.
Yeah,
she's so poor before she's in prison, she is effectively a stateless person.
Yeah.
Her parents, there's like some secret she doesn't really know about,
mm-hmm.
but like they're keeping things super like we're moving all the time. We're, you know, breaking into places, staying there for a bit. And so I think that thinking about the neurodivergence and the poverty are so important when we talk about what the story is trying to do.
Yeah. And I think that without meaning to, I kind of like highlighted something that's really been at the forefront of my mind over the last decade about mental illness, which is, you know, when I was a young person going to college, whatever, the like general understanding of mental illness was based on like a chemical model, right? The idea was like, you know, you were just born with the like a deficiency of serotonin or dopamine in your brain, this neurotransmitter. And at the time, this was like a huge deal. And it was good at the time because it took the shame away from mental illness. Like it wasn't, you know, you, it was this thing that happened in your brain. It's not behavioral. But as a model, like it really fails to account for the reality of the world that we live in, which is that the majority of mental illness is largely contextual, right? So we talk about people with ADHD, and if they're able to like change their life context so that their routines are not maladaptive, that they are able to like regulate their sensory situation, they're able to like, you know, accommodate their executive functioning, then a lot of times all of the like pieces we would categorize under mood disorder, like depression or anxiety, fall away. If we look at people who are in poverty, right, and then we just make their financial situation better, their mental health improves immensely, right? So I think it's really interesting, some of the original critical feedback that I've gotten on this book from early readers who are just like real upset that she's not like mentally healthy or happy. And I don't understand how you could be, to be honest, right? Like just given her context, like it's, I have a couple of friends who are therapists and they talk a lot about how like, it's just such an inadequate model for dealing with the current state of things, right? Like if you're dealing with institutional oppression, if you're dealing with like your compatriots being shot in the street by the police or like, you know, people going into massive debt to like change careers. And then for that industry to suddenly collapse because of private equity, which is happening all across the board in industries you would never guess. Private equity has recently moved into veterinarian offices, which is one reason veterinarians have gotten extremely expensive. It's moved into pharmacies. It's been in nursing care for a long time. It's now moving into daycares because private equity always needs more, you know, fodder. It has to have more industries. It has to grow. And so now we're having a situation where like daycares are getting worse in quality. So it's like how you can't sit down in a room with somebody and talk for like 30 minutes and talk about your coping mechanisms or whatever and solve that. Like it's not going to happen. It's going to mess you up. Sorry. I'm being a bummer. We should talk.
I'm just like, thanks, Reagan, once again.
Yeah, you think you're being a bummer. Monica and awesome. I are like, oh, man, this is exactly the truth.
Yeah. That motherfucker. Okay, so like, oh, you know what? I won't even. Because I'll spiral.
Do it. Let's go.
Be like, what is it about like failed like celebrity, like cis white men just wanting to fuck up everything for everybody? Yeah. Like, or even art school, like actors, like we had fucking Hitler, we had Reagan, and now we have 45. It's just like, why is your failure our problem? And Ooh. Why are you projecting it on everyone? Yeah. They will literally do that instead of going to therapy to figure their shit out, which is also mm-hmm. because of the stigma of mental health, but also context, right? And I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure that they are miserable people, but they're also very thrilled to be projecting their toxicity on everything.
Well, and I don't think it serves them to go to therapy, right? Like there's mm-hmm. a great book called Why Does He Do That? And this is, you know, this book's pretty old. So it's very like, I would say cisnormative and but it's about why abusive men in relationships continue to abuse their partners. And the central thesis of the book, and this was one of the first people who really kind of looked at this research and did this kind of work, is that they do it because it serves them, right? Like if they have a fit and they go around and break everything in the house, they never break their own things. They break your things, right? Like, so it doesn't behoove these people to go to therapy, become better people, because then they have to give up like their massive wealth and their power. And like, they're not going to do that. They're, you know, so yeah, I mean.
Whatever will we do?
We should eat them. Sorry. Probably should like mention that's a callback to a joke that happened off camera. Guys, if I get disappeared or something, just, you know, make sure some, I don't know.
We were talking about prayer. We were going to pray.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. I'm not allowed to pray anymore. I thought this was America.
Oh, it's dark times.
It is dark times. And you know what though? I think I'll just poke this pin hole in the darkness, and it's like a little bit of light coming through. And it's like the stars in the sky. This is a very hopeful story. We can't start there because you can't appreciate the hope. Yeah. But this is a deeply hopeful story. And I want to make sure listeners hear that because I actually found this to be a deeply comforting read right now.
Aww.
And I understand why you feel like it's cozy because, and I struggle to sometimes express this to people because it sounds really fucked up, but it's like the world is really, really bad for a large number of people. But the world does not have to be bad for anyone. Mm-hmm. It actually doesn't. We have enough space. We have enough resources. Do not at me with your overpopulation white supremacy because I will punch you into the sun. Monica. Monica's making a gesture that says we're having none of it. Because we're not. I fucking hate that shit. The problem is not overpopulation. The problem is the overconsumption by the rich. Don't start with me. That is our problem. And this book really honors that, A. Like, the thing is, I can't say a fucking thing about the present without being like, and that brings me back to psychopomp. You know, I was just thinking about, like, the beach, the private beach they have that is, like, so integral to the storytelling, but it's so small relative to the number of words used in that space. I think that when you're writing something that tells the truth about how bad things are, it must be difficult to write in some ways. Although it sounds like it was also cathartic, but there must be some emotional burden, I would think. And it must be hard to talk to people about sometimes because if we tell you what's hopeful about it, we give away the ending. It's like, it's super hopeful, but not maybe the kind of hope that Marvel's trying to give you that is false, that is really just to sell you shit. Like, this is actually a hope that represents when you have no good choices because society has left you behind because fascists are winning, have won. When you have no good choices, you still have choices.
Yeah, I think that the editorial reception to the book was really interesting because so many editors were like, this book is too depressing to read, essentially. And I think the reason I find that interesting is because, like, it means that you don't exist in that space normally, a lot of the time, not always. But, like, people who experience this kind of, like, I would call it structural violence or institutional violence, and maybe that requires rethinking what we define violence as. It's not, like, incredibly uncomfortable to read a book where someone, not necessarily, I mean, there may be times where you're not ready or it's very triggering, but, like, just in and of itself, the fact that something like this exists isn't something, like, I can read that and not, like, fall into my knees, like, crying, right? Like, it's not the worst thing that's ever happened to me to have to think about a situation where someone is, like, uncomfortable or is not at the apex of privilege. But, like, if you never, ever spend time in that space, then you're just like, oh, my God, there's so much here. Whereas, like, I feel like a lot of it's a given, right? Like, of course your mental health's going to be crap. Of course it sucks to live in a debtor's prison on the moon. Like, what, you know? And so then, like, my focus or my interest when I wrote the book, when I read the book, isn't there, right? I'm interested in the other little pieces, like the mysteries and the characterization and the conversations people have with themselves in the past. And so I think that, you know, and this is true of everything I write, I think, based on how it's received, it's not for everybody. It's really, really not for everybody. And if you're the kind of person that's just going to be that likes to put your head in the sand and be like, oh, I don't want to think about these things. Like, you know, I want my fiction to, like, be escapist and beautiful in a particular way. Like, it's not going to be for you, right? That's just kind of like the way that cookie crumbles. But, like, I say that this feels relevant to me as a Korean American, like, who is very aware of, like, the history of Korea, but also my personal family history. Like, I'm never going to exist in that space, right? Like, I was literally driving my car yesterday and I was thinking, like, what if we have to leave? And then I was thinking about all of the people in my family line who had to leave because they just got, like, murdered by the government or were about to get murdered by the government. And it's like, it's not a small number of people, right? And that is, like, if you are Korean, even if you don't know it, like, that is your legacy, right? And I don't know where I'm going with this, but my point is that, like, I don't find the book uncomfortable, right? Like, I don't find it to be this, like, incredibly dark and incredibly oppressive. Like, if you feel that way, then you probably don't really have not connected to, like, what's happening right now even, right? Because it's like, yeah, there's some fantasy dressing on it, but it's not that like, look, they just deported a bunch of Venezuelans to El Salvador. We don't even know who was on the plane. A judge told them not to go and they just did it anyway. And, you know, the whole time everyone's, like, laughing about it and having a great time. It's like, this is happening right now. It's not that different, right? Like, is this moon space prison that they're mining these explosive crystals, like, that different than, like, mining for heavy metals and like all of these people that are dying so we can have iPhones. Like, I don't think it's that different.
In Sudan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. It is just exhausting to say, if we let these things go unchecked, this is where it will lead. And then it's like, fuck me. Like, I don't want to be right. I want us to worry about things before they happen.
Yeah. And I want to write stories in that space that don't necessarily have heroes, right? Like, one of my friends she called me and she was extremely upset because she had been talking to a friend of hers who basically said, like, what's the point? Trump won. Why even protest? Why even fight? And it's somebody who, based on, you know, their lot in life, has never had to go into a fight knowing that they were going to lose. And you and I talked about this, but like, I think a lot of us who haven't had the benefit of that kind of privilege all of the time, like, we have disconnected the fact that we are fighting from the fact that we might win or might lose, because you have to fight either way, even if you know you're going to lose. But a lot of people live their life never, ever entering something where they don't actually know the outcome is that they're going to win. And so, like, now we're in a situation where, like, you know, winning is not assured. In fact, it is fairly unlikely. I mean, at the very, very best case scenario, we have like 8 to 10 years of like extreme pain and a lot of people dying. And that's like, that's the good outcome. That's the best case scenario that we flip this around, I personally think. So, you know, if you look at like the course of traditional publishing and the narratives and stories that usually get given to us in popular media through television, through books, that's not what happens. We don't get narratives where people either already have lost or they know they're going to lose and they continue to like go on anyway and do what they can. They make the small victories they can. That's not like, if you look at the screenwriting guides or whatever, that's not in there, right? Like at the end, the hero has to win. And that's why we want the story. We want to feel good. So it's like, I don't know, but as I age particularly, I become more and more interested in writing stories in that other space, right? The one that is actually more reflective of the world that we live in. Sorry, I'm just like going off forever.
I like listening to you talk.
Oh, I get nervous.
I'm also agreeing with you on marginalized people in this country. Like, we already know what's up. Like, I grew up pretty poor on the north side of Milwaukee, very small. Like, I mean, the city was segregated as fuck. And like, that's always been like a part of the culture of most Midwest cities, if we want to be honest about it. And so, you know, survival is pretty much just like trying to make it through the day without having somebody say something fucked up to you or being profiled, being followed in a store. Like, we already know what it's about to be surveillance consistently. We already know what it's like to, you know, go into the wrong neighborhood and be kind of nervous because you don't have, you know, you don't look like you belong in that neighborhood. Or shit, even in your own neighborhood, you're walking somewhere and they like, you don't look like you should live in the neighborhood. You know what I'm saying? So like, I feel like a lot of people like after 45 won or whatever, I still call him 45, like, I don't know. After he won, it was like this moment where I feel a lot of Black people were like, well, we told y'all. Like, it's like, and I saw like the numbers on like who voted for who. And it was like 95% Black women went for it. So like Octavia Butler, right? She's written so many prophetic things. And like Black women have always been at the forefront of almost every major movement, only to still be ignored. Yep. And so I think that like, and this is me personally, I've disconnected for my own self-preservation because it's pretty clear that individualism has won. Like that American culture, like that is won. Like it is what it is. But also it made it very clear that Black women are kind of like, we're on our own, you know, like we're kind of just in this circle where, you know, no matter how loud we scream or like no matter how we try to like build things, whatever else, some people are just comfortable with seeing the world burn because they know that they have a slight chance of not getting burned by it. You know what I'm saying? Like, and it's so loud, especially with social media. Like you see people's like true colors like coming out. You know what I'm saying? And it's actually, I think that it's really cool that you are able to write these stories, but also find it as a means of processing these things yourself, because I also feel like that's super important. My tactic is just to smoke weed and stare at a wall sometimes. So I think you're...
You don't know this about me, but I actually can't really do marijuana. So I get a little too high and for a little too long. And so it's like, yeah.
Do you remember, Monica, do you remember the end of the Birds of Prey, the Harley Quinn and the Birds of Prey comic where Harley gets like hurt? And so then they're like passing her between the Birds of Prey, like being like, I can't help her anymore. Like, it's your turn. That's what happens to Maria. With, like, her friends were like passing her around.
Oh, no.
Just being like, okay, it's your turn to take her. Cause you were high for what, 3 days?
Yeah. It was crazy. Yeah. I think I don't break alcohol down well because a lot of Asians don't. So I wonder if it's like something related with like not being able to break down some of the compounds that are produced. But like, yeah, I'll be high for an extremely long time.
That is wild.
Yeah, and it's like, and then afterwards, I don't remember any of it, right? So
you like black out, essentially?
Well, I don't, at the time, I don't feel blacked out. Like, apparently I'm walking, talking, having conversations and stuff. But then when I'm not high, I have like almost no memory of what happened during that time period. So yeah, it's not like, honestly, I'm just too lazy to have to coordinate like 3 days of babysitters. And like, it's a lot. I don't have that in me anymore. Yeah.
So you're right.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I had to write some novels because what else are you gonna do, right? Like,
be high for 3 days or write a novel? Which one will it be?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's real. If you're a fan of the podcast and want to hear even more excellent interviews, get sneak peeks into everything else we're up to, and be the first to know what's up with the lovely bitches, we hope you'll join us on Patreon at patreon.com/queerspec, where we already have hundreds of bonus episodes and other content and add more every month. Usually.
Have a book in the publication pipeline, especially a debut, you kind of are on hold with everything else
Until
that book goes through.
Yeah, because usually your contract stipulates that you have what's called an option on the book, right? And so like with Liar, Dreamer, Thief, when we were in the process of going through the publication process, like editing, formatting, all that stuff, I wasn't allowed to send anything anywhere else because they had an option on my next book. But they also didn't want to look at the book until like my current book was like done. Like basically, you know, turned in, all the edits were done, and it was then like in the next part. And that takes like, you know, a year to year and a half. So, and that's pretty typical. Also, science fiction and fantasy is a pretty small world in the traditional publishing space. There's like 4 or 5 major imprints. And so what happens is if you have a fantasy novel, for example, and you go out to these like 5 houses, like you can't go out to that same house with something else at the same time, even if it's a different editor. And your agent, if they have someone else who's like, you know, writing that stuff, you don't want them to compete with each other, right? You don't want like your client to take a spot from your other client. So Your agent's constantly playing, what do you call that? Like, you know, that wooden puzzle game where you push the pieces around and then move the
piece. You try and make the picture?
Yeah, which is also in the book. So I'm sad that I don't know what it's called.
It is in the book. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Whoopsie daisy. Yeah, puzzle piece pusher hole, okay? Like your agent's playing puzzle piece pusher hole. But also like you are playing puzzle piece pusher hole with yourself. Yeah. Cause, and then also like, even if you, let's say like every single thing you write, your publisher immediately is like, yes, I want this. Your books, they have to have at least a year delay between them. And some publishers like a year and a half. So yeah, if you write quickly, you're going to be stuck for a long time. I don't write quickly anymore because I have a child and a job, and that basically is like from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. That's it. That's all I do. And then like, if I'm lucky, I have an hour at night to work on something, and I am working on something right now. But yeah, so for the last like 4 or 5 years, you know, we were slowly working through this huge backlog of manuscripts I had written. And so like, I have all of these books that like no one's even like seen, right? Because like, yeah.
And then that's part of why you took Psychopomp to Dark Matter, right?
Yeah. So basically, we went out on submission with it, and science fiction is even smaller than fantasy. Like there's probably 3 publishers that actually are doing science fiction, particularly anything that doesn't have a romantic element. Or isn't like super grounded. Like if it's really, really grounded, like it's in our world and there's like one little sci-fi element or something, then, you know, a lot of times a commercial publisher that's like, when I say commercial, I mean not science fiction, fantasy, not genre fiction, like your standard like books at Walmart kind of situation, might pick it up. But that book is science fiction. And at the time, science fiction was even smaller than it is now. It's kind of having a little bit of like a resurgence. Like I'm seeing more and more sci-fi come out, even from commercial publishers. Like Yumi Kitase's The Deep Sky came out from Flatiron, who doesn't traditionally do a lot of sci-fi. Ocean's Godori came out from, that's Elaine Cho. I just started reading it. It's amazing. It's so good. It made me feel stupid. I was like, oh, this is what my book would have liked to have been, but it was not. Anyway, that's not important. And that came out through Zando. So like you are seeing more commercial publishers starting to kind of like sprinkle in a little science fiction. But at the time it was very tight market, especially because we were in the middle of a pandemic, right? And at that moment, almost all publishers were like, let's just go down to our very core lines, whatever those are. And so sci-fi, like, or anything kind of mixed genre just like went out the window. So yeah, we went out on submission, I think early 2019, maybe mid 2019. And then it died very, very quickly comparatively. And then it just sat in a drawer. And then I wrote book after book after book after book, and my agent was taking them out. And I was like, I was also growing as a writer. Like I knew that this book, at some point, I wasn't going to want to go back to it and try to publish it anymore. And I really wanted it to exist. But I was also very particular about what it looked like, because I had an experience with my first book where, you know, there were a lot of changes made to kind of make the book more palatable to like your average reader or like a more general audience. And like, this book is like really personal. I didn't want to do that with this book. Like, it's weird. It's a weird book. There's like, I don't know, there's a scene where there's something really big in a Tupperware that's not normally in a Tupperware is what I'll put it. And like, I just knew that in a commercial press, they're going to be like, this is weird. You can't do that. And I didn't want to do that. So I kind of resolved to just like let it die. And then it turns out that I knew Marie Croak, who at the time was one of the editors over at Dark Matter, because I had edited some of her work in a magazine for Apparition Literature, I believe. And I really loved her work. So I thought, well, I really love her work. I know her work. I feel like she would get this book. I'm going to send it over to her because I kind of, you know, I know her well enough personally to feel like she would treat this book well if she wanted it. And then she, you know, emailed back and said that she'd like to buy it. So they bought it at Dark Matter, and it's coming out March 25th.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
This episode will actually air on the 26th.
Oh, so okay. It will have been out for a day.
Lucky listeners, you can go pick up your copy right now. Pretty much anywhere. It's available pretty much everywhere. So bookshop, right?
Yeah, you can get it on bookshop.org. Yeah, you don't have to go to Amazon. Yep, anywhere Ingram.
You can also get it directly from Dark Matter as well.
Yep. I should have started there.
Dark Matter magazine. I should have started there. I led you down that road.
It's actually available in a lot of places. Like you can get it at Powell's, you know, in like Oregon, right? Yeah. Like every so often I Google myself because I have to like add stuff to my bio, and I never do it when it happens. So then retroactively I have to go back and like, what did people say about me, and put it in there. And I was surprised by how many bookstores I saw come up on, even like internationally, there's a ton.
It reminds me of something that Tanana Reeve Dew said, which was, she added ghosts to the reformatory because she wanted it to be fun. Yeah. She was like, otherwise, this is really grim shit. And I feel like that clicked so hard for me because I remember thinking, reading the reformatory and being like, holy fucking shit. And being like, but what the fuck are they going to do about the ghosts? You know what I mean? Like, I'm really, like, there was such a pacing it gave the book. Mm. And I think that that's what I really love about science fiction and fantasy is the ability to tell us truly awful stories, because the world is truly awful. I'm sorry if you don't experience that way. Good for you, but you might want to get in the trenches with the rest of us. Yeah. Because it is a very hard place to be, and this is a very hard time to be in it. It doesn't have to be that way. I'm a firm believer of that. But I think that science fiction and fantasy, I always think about it as like, it's the spoonful of sugar that like helps you take the medicine, right? Like I find it easier. I find my brain works in different ways when I think about a fictional moon prison than when I'm reading like a book about incarceration in the United States. Both are important for me to read, but they make my mind move in different ways. And so I think that that's the real gift of getting to write these stories where, you know, maybe sometimes the moon talks. I don't know. I maybe that could happen in the book. You know, and like that's so cool because it is, that's also the piece of the hope, right? Is like you get to spool out these stories for us that are full of pain and grief. And then they're full of what gets to come after those things.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting that you said it was a horror novel, because you and I've had this conversation recently about like, where do my books belong? And you're like, they're horror books, Maria. And I'm like, are they though? And you're like, no, they are. And you know, I've been coming around to that idea a lot. I would have pitched this as probably a mystery novel, right? So like, yes, there are all these really depressing things happening, but also there is a mystery. There's something going on, and she wants to...
It's fun!
Yeah, she wants to figure out what it is, and also sometimes things explode. Like, it's very, you know...
And she's so funny, man. Like, she does, like, the stupidest things sometimes, and then she's like, I am so... Why would I do that? Like, why would a person ever make this decision? And I... Listeners, you don't know this, but we were trying to start the call, and I could not find my computer. I did not know where my computer was. I need my computer every day. How did I do this? Where did my beautiful wife find it? Face down. It has a touch screen. Thank you. Face down on a pair of boots by the door. Why?
Because ADHD is like living with ADHD. A ghost in your house that just walks around and puts things in random places. And now I have a 2-year-old. Well, she's actually 14 months old, but and she does that. So now it's like, I don't know if I put this thing in the freezer or if she put it in the freezer, but somebody put it in the freezer, you know. So yeah, I'm going insane.
There's this point where Young hurts her ankle, mm-hmm. and she gets medical care because, you know, the capitalists need their machines to keep running. But then she keeps forgetting she's hurt. And then it'll be just like so bad. The pain will be so awful out of like, and she'll feel like it's out of nowhere. And the really funny thing is, if you could see me right now, listeners, you would see that I have a splint on my hand because I hurt my thumb watching a scary movie. I popped my knuckles so many times because I was afraid. And then I read The Reformatory afterwards and it held too big of a book with my thumb. And so now I have a brace. And I feel like I am constantly forgetting that I'm hurt. And that's why it's helpful. But I think like that storyline ends up being so funny in the book and bringing so much realism at the same time. Like, it's funny to have ADHD. It is like you're haunted by a ghost and the ghost is you. And sometimes your toddler in this case.
Yeah, I think that one thing I've noticed about my writing is that I don't let anyone take themselves too seriously. So, like, I'll have a first draft where someone's like, you know, they're a villain and they're so dark and cool and they're a predator that eats people or whatever. And then by, like, draft 4, they, like, can't get their trunk open or, you know, they're stuck in the bathroom and the handle has fallen off because it doesn't matter how badass you are, okay? You're still subject to, like, doorknobs and whatnot. And so I think that, like, yeah, she's like doing this mystery. A lot of things are happening, but also like that's one of my least favorite things that happens in movies and books is like someone gets injured and it's like completely inconsequential. And also, or they like remember it perfectly. And that's not what I used to be an occupational therapist and people re-injured themselves constantly because they just forgot they were hurt. Like that's really, really common. It's like extremely common around like 6 to 10 weeks because you're starting to feel better. You're not in pain anymore every time you move. You can kind of do some things. And then you just kind of forget that you're not supposed to like run after a bus or something. Like that's pretty common. Yeah.
It's so real.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that in the future of sci-fi as a whole, do you think that, because I know that you mentioned that the business, like more like mainstream, like publishing houses are releasing more. Do you think that in this current dystopia that we live in, do you see this possibly going away? Because it's going to be so hard to blend the, you know, to like actually imagine, because we're actually going through the steps of like a techno-feudalist like society. Like that's pretty yeah. much where we're heading. You know what I mean? Like the broligarchy is here.
Yeah.
And we have to like actually confront the fact that the reason why we've seen so much apathy from so many people, in addition to what we talked about earlier, is because they are solely into this idea of technology being the number one thing that we can fight fascism with, but also disinformation. Like the enshittification of everything. Like it's not only going to be limited to like technology, but like it could also infiltrate every other discipline that we could possibly think of, film, books, whatever you name it. And so I'm just like also wondering about the future of speculative fiction as a whole. Because yeah. at one point, when does it become a memoir? You know what I'm saying? So I really just want to know your hopes and dreams.
Well,
for the future.
Yeah. So, wow, this could be like a whole hour in and of itself. But I think the first thing we have to think about is that for a very long time, almost every single book that you got at a bookstore or a library had to come through New York and the traditional publishing machine. And that's still for the most part true. Like the vast majority of books that are, you know, at these places that people can access books come from this traditional publishing machine. But there are a lot of factors that are changing our access to fiction and the kind of fiction that's available. So for example, when you see like a publishing house now, there's like four publishing houses basically, and they have tons and tons of imprints. Historically, a lot of those imprints were separate publishing houses. There used to be kind of this like thriving ground of like all of these different publishing houses that all got absorbed into these like bigger houses. And so now they're all part of the same masthead and they all kind of follow the same rules and they're getting more and more concentrated. And it's gotten so bad that like the Department of Justice has got involved and said like, we can't merge Penguin Random House and this other publishing house together because that would literally form, it would be like 50% of the fiction in the United States coming out of one company, right? And so that's happening. Another thing that's happening is like the filmification of books, which is like, it has been happening for a long time, but it's gotten worse and worse because less and less people are reading. Reading requires time. It also requires either access to a really good library or access to money to buy books. And, you know, the average wage of a person has fallen as the cost of books have gone up. So if you think about like the 90s, you only made like $5 an hour. My first job, I made four something an hour. But a book was like four, maybe $5, right? Now you still make $7.25 an hour and a book is like, my debut was like $30 in hardback. It was insane. And you really don't see mass market paperbacks anymore, like the real cheap ones that they used to have at like the grocery store. You know, I mean, like you might see like a couple books at Target and that's like, so reading has gotten more expensive. Other forms of entertainment are cheaper because of venture capital, right? So for example, Netflix isn't profitable. They can't actually run a service where you watch all of these movies for like $20 a month or whatever. So like they have these huge infusions of cash that are coming in from like investors, right? But they're not actually like, they haven't actually made their business balance out. And so like, A, you have people whose attention is being split and you're competing as a writer and as fiction for attention economy. B, the kinds of stories that you're seeing unfold are blinded by the traditional publishing model of being like these four companies, one of which is now owned by private equity, which is terrible. But also like the fact that now if you want to make money as a writer, a lot of times the majority of the money you can make is through film sale or TV sale. So a lot of times when publishing houses are acquiring books now, they're looking for that commonality of story that they see in film and TV. So we're driving more and more toward that structure, right? The like really weird novel or the novel that's doing things only novels can do, that's becoming rarer and rarer because of that. And then also we're seeing less and less like early career writers. Basically, we have this like debut culture. You either have to be like brand new, no one's ever heard of you, it's your very first book and it goes to auction and then the publishing house is going to support it. Or you have to be somebody who by yourself, by your own name, brand name recognition is going to bring in money. And so like, you know, like you're Nora Jones or whatever, right? This like mid-list author that's in the middle where like you're kind of like you're working your way up and the publishing house is helping you grow your career because they're investing in you because you're investing in them. Like that doesn't really exist anymore in the same way, which is all to say, like as far as the future of speculative fiction, good speculative fiction is going to exist and it's probably going to come out of small presses, right? That's the way it's going to be. And we are seeing, I think, and maybe this is part of the technological side of things, a growth in small presses that are doing cool things because they have access to tools. Like if you want, you can just go put your novel in Create Space or Lightning Source or Ingram Direct, or I think it's Ingram Spark now, and just like distribute it to bookstores. You can do that yourself. So I think that we're seeing that. I also think that we're going to see more and more storytelling happening in interesting ways, like in a non-book space, right? So Essie and I were talking a lot recently about audio dramas, essentially, like, because honestly, I struggle with audiobooks because they're not, a lot of times when you write a book, it's not designed to be an audio. And so like, I know with my debut, a lot of people complained that they didn't understand what was happening because the book kind of has like three books in one and the audio isn't super clear about like which book you're in. If you're in the magical world book or like the mathematics book, or if you're in just like regular world book. So like, I think that there's a push toward storytelling in like, you know, games, in audio dramas. Like we're just going to see more and more people using creative and different mediums to tell stories because books are kind of this like static space in a way, right? Like the money's all tied up in New York and private equity soon. I bet they're coming after all the publishers. Why wouldn't they, right? And it's kind of a bummer. But I do think there's going to be interesting things happening. And I think a lot of it's going to be happening in small presses or in game design. You know, I think like Disco Elysium had some great storytelling in it. And that's a game, right? And that people are just going to, I think we're going to have like cool fiction happening in a decentralized way. I think that fiction as a job is going to be difficult. It's become more and more difficult, regardless of the industry that you're in. And that's going to continue to happen. Unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with AI. I don't know where I'm going with this. So,
I mean, I think it was an incredible description of the landscape of publishing. Like, that was just so informative. Mm-hmm. I always love hearing you talk about it because you're very analytical, very cut and dry about it. You're like, it works this way. Here's the problem. Here's what's happening. Here's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Here's what's already happened. Here's what we think it'll happen more. And it's like, good argument, Maria. I completely understand it. I agree with you now.
I mean, yeah, there's just so many factors, right? But like, I think that AI, venture capital, private equity, attention to, like, these are all huge factors. But I do think interesting storytelling is going to be happening no matter what, right? Like, the group that makes Fallen London, which is this extremely old browser game that has some really deep, interesting storytelling in it. I think they had like a record for Kickstarter, to make like a different, I think it's a tabletop game, right? So like, I can't say what's going to happen. I think that creators generally are going to have to be a little more comfortable flowing between mediums if they really want to be able to like eat. So I have a day job and that is really good for me now, even though it takes all of my creative energy and I'm very tired and I don't write very much anymore. I still think it's good because I don't think I would do well in this current environment trying to make it as a person whose entire income is coming from creative pursuits, right? Like I don't think I could handle it right now. It's not great.
Mm. And I think a lot of people are struggling. I mean, I've seen more calls for commissions than maybe ever before, mm-hmm. Or more open, you know, people saying I'm open to commissions is what I should say. And it makes sense. I mean, that's a big part of how artists survive of all stripes is making a myriad of different pursuits work at the same time. And that is really, really exhausting. I find it very difficult to actually be creative mm-hmm. when I have to do all of that stuff, you know?
Yeah. I will say someone said to me, I think it was the day before yesterday, she said, this is Egan Daniels. She's a writer. And she said, and she's great. I love her, her debut. She said, well, at least fascism is really good for art. And it's kind of true, right? Because when your life is great and you're out living it, you don't really have time to like read a bunch of books or whatever. But I have a feeling that all of us might have like some more, we're not going to be going out as much. We're not going to be going to the movies as much, you know? So like, what are you going to do? Maybe make some art. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the people who survive it
we should cancel this
create space for them.
Cause it's like this episode should not air. It's like the most depressing episode.
It's the truth though.
It's the truth. Here's the thing. We're here. We're in the final stretch. We got 16 minutes to go. Baby, life is hard, but let us sing of hope.
Yeah.
Let us sing of hope because mm-hmm. here's the fucking rub. Young is put in situations where there are no good choices.
Yeah.
And your choice, and when you are in that situation, you still have to make a choice. You still have to make a choice. And what do you make that choice for? For Young, I think for the three of us, I'm going to guess for the majority of our listeners, actually. The basis of that choice is liberation.
Mm.
Liberation for me, liberation for you. And in fact, there is no liberation for me without liberation for you. One of my least favorite tropes in prison, I don't really enjoy a lot of fiction set in prisons.
I don't either.
I think people really don't understand what prison is.
Yeah.
My mother spent a good portion of my childhood in prison. I have spent a lot of times in prisons.
You mean it's not like Orange is the New Black? Is that not what prison's like?
Oh, God.
I can't even watch it because I tried and I was like, I can't. and I'm not mad at people for like, you know, whatever. I don't care.
Like what you like,
but for me, the quintessential prison story is the Count of fucking Monte Cristo. Mm. That's the blueprint. And if you want to be real, you want to write a prison story, okay, let's do it. Let's actually do it because it is important to speak about what happens to incarcerated people. Mm. It's important no matter who is president, because this is unacceptable that we have found a loophole to allow enslavement. Mm-hmm. That is completely unacceptable. And it's worse now given who is president. 45 is a fucking monster and wants to be one and is having a good time fucking with people's lives. Mm-hmm. That's sad.
Yeah.
But within that framework, we have choices. And Young uses her choices knowing that it might not benefit her. I'm gonna fucking cry. I love this book so fucking much.
I think another piece of it too is the fact that like when you make everyone miserable, people are gonna start doing crazy things, right? Like whenever someone says, oh, her choices don't make sense, I'm like, what does she have to lose, right? Like she's falling apart. So I think it's gonna be interesting times very soon because a lot of people are gonna be very uncomfortable that were previously very comfortable. And perhaps those people will decide to take some actions in a, I don't want to guess like censored, can I say Luigi style situation?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I just, that's why we have labor laws in the first place. Cause people were dying. People were getting raped by their employer. And the next thing you know, they like were, you know, I
always think about how like anybody that is against any type of protections don't realize how many laws have been written in blood.
Yeah.
Oof.
Like literal blood, like mm-hmm. sacrifice. Yep. And like, if you don't have empathy for those who have less than you or who are different than you, I just don't know, man. Like that's some like serious monster ass shit. And I just like can't help but think that because of, you know, having nice libraries or like cutting funding to like XYZ, this is why we are at this moment where people have forgotten why we have the things that we do, you know, because mm-hmm. they were failed. They were failed by educational systems.
Absolutely.
Et cetera.
History, by media, so, especially.
By media.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And like not being taught media literacy. Also.
Absolutely.
Critical thinking. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's one, fascinating that they've been able to do this on like a large systemic level, but like also it's really, really, it makes things complicated for us who are trying to process it healthily, but also try to figure out how to survive, but also how to make sure that our communities stay alive as well, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think this episode should air because
I feel
like I'm going to have my network moment where it's just like, I don't want you to stay at home. I want you to get angry. You never seen The Network? No? Oh, geez.
No.
70s cinema.
Okay, but done. I'm in.
Okay, yeah, there you go. It has Faye Dunaway in it. But like, it's about this guy who's a news reporter. He finally just crashes out and he has this very like famous monologue at the end where he's talking about like, you know, everybody just wants to stay at home, you know, and have their TV and their dinner sets and like whatever. And like, all this shit is happening. But like, aren't you upset? Like, I want you to actually get angry. Like, I want you to scream out the window, I am a human being.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really good movie. You should see it. But yeah, like, I feel like it just, some people have to like hit rock bottom before it actually feels real. That's all it
is. Yeah, I think a lot of people will eventually come around to class consciousness because they're going to lose all of the comfort that they have. And it's horrible that so many people are going to have to suffer for that to happen. But I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm saying that this is the inevitable outcome, right? Yep. If you take away everything from people and they have yep. nothing left, then there's absolutely nothing to stop them from doing whatever the heck they want, right? Mm-hmm. That's how we get Mangione situations. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not a historian or a good forecaster of anything. I just pick up vibes and vibe them into fiction, but I just, it's a weird time to be like 40, right? Because you just look at like, I think we were like that one little sliver where like people, as they entered adulthood, like they kind of felt like some hope, right? And then, the recession.
Absolutely. Oh, millennials are like so, we're not okay.
We were going to solve like, global warming.
Yeah, oh, we were on it.
No, it just got steadily worse.
Like, yeah.
It's yeah.
Like so much worse than we could have ever imagined.
Yeah.
And somehow at every juncture, we got blamed.
Yeah.
We're still getting blamed.
Which is like very 40. Strange. I'm like, oh, okay. Sure. You mean all those laws that predate me being born? Yeah, those are on me. I appreciate that.
Let's just be real, though. Most of the people that are in power that are doing all the chaos are from a certain boom generation. So
aren't they, though?
I don't know if that has to do.
Boom and older? Like, like what?
Oh, yeah, the silent age.
You mean the walking skeletons?
Which is crazy. The silent age, my dudes. Like, these are like mummies, dead ass.
No, I think you can hear the skeleton bones clicking when you walk down the halls of Congress. It's just like
Mitch McConnell glitched out in real time in 8K on television, and he is still running things. Sit and ask yourselves, people. Also, and this is I'm not a Democrat. Like, that's the tea. Yeah. Like, they're the same side.
Oh, yeah.
They have lunch together, you guys. Like, all those people that are, like, talking shit in the news, it's theater. These people go to the same restaurants. They go to the same parties. They went to the same Ivy Leagues. They are all in it together. It is them versus us, and that's pretty much it. Clear cut. There's no in-betweens. Even if you make $300,000, my dude, you are not in that club. I'm sorry. Nothing. Like, it's just, like, happening.
Yeah. You know, Vita Ayala, and you know, I love them so much. I think it's a Blue Sky post. So I think they skeeted that. They said there's only one real binary, and it's fascist and anti-fascist. Mm. It's the only one that's really real. You don't get to play in the middle anywhere there.
Yep. Yeah.
You make your call. And I think I've thought about that a lot recently, because I think right now is the time that white people in particular need to be called into this moment. And cishet white people particularly, but we can just talk about white people in general, because there's a lot of queer white people who need to get our lives right. Trans white people need to get their lives right. Our lives right. Like, yeah, we need to be called into this movement. But the thing is, it's like, I just want people to acknowledge how bad things are, because they're afraid to do that because it might make things worse. Mm. But the truth of the matter is, it's getting worse. And acknowledging how bad it is actually helps us as human beings. This is me preaching, so I'm going to preach. It's my podcast. It helps us as human beings to connect into something that I think is righteous, which is it's the insolent part of us. It's the rage-filled part of us. It's the way that, for me, my skin crawls when I see a prison. Tear them all down. Tear them all down, because if they can say that person did something illegal, and that means that they can incarcerate them, enslave them, and subject them to abuses I wouldn't dare imagine, they can do it to me. Mm. And I don't care how white you are. I don't care how cis you are. I don't care how straight you are. If they don't ever come for you, they are still making you complicit. This blood is on all of our hands. Even if we didn't vote for this, even if we don't want this, even if we hate the Democrats, and believe it, we do, that doesn't absolve any of us. And so the idea of sitting this one out, and I am speaking to white people, of protecting yourselves or of being focused on the ways these laws affect you first and foremost, is to leave our Black and brown and Asian siblings out to dry, our Indigenous siblings out to dry. And that actually is who is facing this first, worst wave. You can't do the "they came for the fucking bullshit" because they came for queer and trans people and no one fucking put them in the poem. So don't wait for them to come for anybody. Find somewhere to fight and fight. Just find one thing to fight on and fight. And that's how we turn a tide, because alone, none of us is sufficient. None of our efforts will ever be sufficient alone. But together, we're unstoppable. So find your fight. And that's the end of my sermon.
Every time I see that "they came for us" like poem meme thing, me as a Black person, I'm just like, the fuck? They never left.
Yeah,
what do you mean? What are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
Where are you? Where there's like, "they came for like, bruh." Like, I don't know if you've been
following. They're still coming.
But they've been there, so.
Yeah, I think it's interesting they invoke the Alien Enemies Act or whatever it's called, because it's like the same one we used to inter Asians, if I'm not mistaken. I was like, this act looks real familiar in name.
Yes, that is correct.
So we're just gonna do that. And I, just to be clear, like, I think particularly my East Asian brothers and sisters and siblings, we often align ourselves with white people and against our own interests, and we should take a hard look at that. But I thought that was funny, because there's so many of us that, you know, support what's happening, that have like gotten on the Republican train, and then they roll out this act and I'm like, you can't see my face because you're, I'm like, look at it. Like, look at it. They're not your friend.
Doesn't this ring a bell?
It's not your friend. Not your friend. Yeah. So it's random. Sorry. But
no, it's not random. It's actually dead on. And I think that's just, that's the clarion call of this moment. Get nasty. You know what? Take your little Karen energies and point them in the right direction for once. I have no, be a Karen, but go yell at a fucking senator.
Yeah.
Go yell at Donald Trump. Stop yelling at black people. Fuck.
I think that to close this out, we should make a list of things that have given us joy recently, because everything yes! is terrible. And I will start with like the videos of Republican town halls where their own constituents who have like been filleting them for years get up there and like, you don't care about me. And I'm like, no, they don't. They don't. Good job. Good job. Like, I just, it gives me joy, right? It gives me joy to hear that like every Tesla in Germany is on fire right now. Like, you know, I just, you got to take your joy where you can get it, right? Like, I don't know.
I think. I like the subreddit called Lepers Ate My Ate My Face. Mm-hmm. And I look at that daily because, like, we knew it was coming. I mean, I remember 2016 and up until whenever he was out, it was the same shit. It was the people who were like, COVID's not real. And then they ended up getting, you know, exactly. And it's like the same thing. But I agree with you, SE. Things are like getting to a level of evil that is unprecedented, like in on this soil, whatever the fuck. I mean, genocide was at the beginning of this country.
Exactly. Before, like, exactly.
As far as like the fascists being outward about it, because the United States has been an oligarchy forever. This is not new.
Yes.
This is just them being bold enough to be like, yes, this is who we are. And we still don't even know who the real wealthy ones are behind like the characters that we see.
The puppeteers. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So I think that people are just in denial at the moment. But there are also some people who legitimately thought that they were on the winning team. And so I don't know. I get a kick out of it because I'm just like, well.
Yeah. I mean, that's my we have to wrap up pretty quick here, but my firmest belief is there can never be democracy on stolen land. I just think that we fucked this up and it's going to take a lot more than white people to fix it. But I need white people to be fucking up the other white people. That's what we have to do. I call my senator's office every fucking day and I yell about something at this twink. You know what I mean?
I can't even call my representative anymore. He's like turned off the voice. Like he didn't like all the calls coming in. So he decided...
You got to get his fax number.
I think they've turned everything off. You can't.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You can't do that. You're that's public fucked. Servant.
There's no law that says they have to. And even if there was, they wouldn't listen to it.
No, what do they care about laws?
I will cite that when I turn off my phone and then my boss asks me, like, where were you? And I'd be like, well, you know, it just like you called too many times. And
I just couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle it. So I'm just going to turn it off. Well, the thing that's bringing me, I'm just going to wrap us up because Maria's got to go get her kid. The thing that's bringing me joy is you two. Aww. Honest to God. I'm not kidding. Getting to have these kinds of conversations with people who are creating fiction, who are creating art, who are investing what time we have in a hope like creating art to create right now is to say, I believe there will be something in the future. That's beautiful. That's hopeful. And I really hope that all of our listeners can find ways to connect with that hope, big and small. Maria, we're going to get you out of here, but where can people find you online?
You can find me at mariadong.com. That's dong as in paint. No, I'm kidding. Sorry. I decided to reclaim, it's my Korean family name, and people made fun of it. And then after a while, I thought, you know what? No, I'm just going to come out with like right out of the gate. Yes, it's dong. Dong, dong. Dong, gong, 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 gong. Okay. MariaDong.com. I am on TikTok and I'm also on Blueski, and that's it. I am no longer on any of the other social medias, and it's very liberating. So
good for you. Good for you. Anymore. Maria, thank you so much for being here with us today. You are such a delight. I love these interviews because I'm like, Monica, we can't prepare too much for Maria. We are not going to get to any agenda. We just got to go have fun. ADHD. It was a triple threat. And what a good time we have had. Kate, thank you for editing out the parts where I sneezed. I don't know if I actually sneezed, but I like to say that. Listeners, thanks for being here. Patrons, we couldn't be here without you. You pay the bills. You keep the mics on, as I like to say. I like all my little sayings. I don't know. I'm just like a gnome with sayings.
Do gnomes have sayings? Gnome.
I don't know. They do now. That's the show.
Official.
All right. Love you all.
I love the you end. Too.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Bitches on Comics is a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Blue Sky at Bitches on Comics. You can sign up for our newsletter, listen to any of our episodes, find curated lists of where to start listening, read interviews available nowhere else, and learn about our other projects and upcoming appearances at bitchesoncomics.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also buy us a coffee or send us a one-time morale boost at ko-fi.com/queerspec. That's ko-fi.com/queerspec.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to our Patreon page at patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Essie Fleenor, and you can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at essiefleenor. You know, the whole thing.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at my website, Audrey's Revenge Film, listed below. Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
If you like Bitches on Comics, you might also enjoy our narrative fiction podcast, Decoded Horror Channel, available wherever you get your podcasts or at decodedpride.com.
Be sure to check out our show notes to find a link to donate to campaigns engaged in important work.